Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Dave Newman. Dave Newman has worked as a warehouse manager, college professor, truck driver, substitute school teacher, waiter, and a ghoul in a haunted house. He is the author of the novel Please Don't Shoot Anyone Tonight and four poetry chapbooks. Most recently, Allen Ginsberg Comes to Pittsburgh. He lives in Trafford, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Prosody, Dave.
Thank you so much for having me.
How about we start out tonight with you reading a little bit?
I'm going to read a chapter. There's three main characters in my book. They're all teenagers. They're all kind of in trouble. There's two boys and one girl who thinks she's pregnant. And they're pulling up to the family planning clinic right now. And the narrator, Danny, has kind of a flashback before they go in. The clinic was not clearly marked like I remembered it, but it was there. And after more turns, we spotted the discreet sign. Maybe this wasn't even the same clinic. Maybe if you look close, there were clinics everywhere, each one slightly different than the rest. I'd been here, or someone like here, 3 years ago with my junior high girlfriend and her older sister. The sister, who acted like our mother, wanted us to be safe. She didn't think we should be having sex at our age, 14, but if we're going to have sex, we should not make babies. Making babies was the worst thing that could happen from having sex. She really liked us, was happy we were together, but she didn't approve. I didn't even know if I approved. I didn't know what I was approving of. I was not having sex. I wanted to, had tried to, but we were not. So I nodded from the back seat. When we parked, I noticed the big sister's nails, long and red. They were glamorous. It was like they'd been painted for sex. She put on her sunglasses. My girlfriend didn't have sunglasses. She looked small and confused. I felt small and confused too, but mostly horny for the sister and her nails and her sunglasses. Then I didn't look at anyone or say anything. The girls went inside. Maybe I was supposed to go inside too, but I didn't move and they didn't wave me on. When they came back, they each had a huge white plastic bag filled with condoms and foam and lube and brochures. I looked inside. It was like a sex shop, what I imagined a sex shop to be like. I wondered how this stuff worked and if any of it was edible. I looked at the sister and she said, "That smile is too big." And she reached back and wiped her hand across my mouth, but just joking. I went back to reading the boxes and tubes in the white bag filled with sex. The big sister got pregnant. Before that, their mom had found an empty bottle of foam in the garbage can and flipped out. My girlfriend and I kept touching, asking if it felt okay. We did not make a baby. Then, one night, we were going to have sex. On the night she called and said, "I think I want to do it tonight." On the night we met in a field with a blanket and a towel, I put on a condom, and before I could even lay across her, she started to cry. Gently at first, then harder than I had ever seen a girl cry. And for a second, I thought this might be rape. I thought I might have been raping her, whatever rape was. I took the condom off. I started to apologize. She said, "It's not you," and kept on crying. I wanted to cry too, to show I wasn't a rapist, to show I thought touching was okay. But I couldn't. I was hard and it hurt. We put our clothes on, then we wrapped ourselves up in the blanket. After that, we went home. I had three condoms, and I left them all in the woods, two unopened, one unrolled and empty. My girlfriend wasn't my girlfriend after that. I didn't think of the Latrobe Clinic that night or any other night for what seemed like a very long time. Now we were here. Matt said, "Is there like an emergency room?" I said, "It's not a hospital." Susan said, "I'm more nervous than I should be." The building was a renovated Pizza Hut. Even though it had been painted, and the greens and reds were now beiges and browns, the old shape, the funky roof, and the square bottom was still obvious. We parked out back in a lot lined with meters. The meters lined up like an abandoned city made of silver towers. Matt said, "How long do you think it'll take?" None of us knew. We looked at the meters, and I imagined time as silver change. We all checked our pockets for quarters. Nobody had anything. Susan said, "It doesn't matter. I need to do this alone." Matt said, "I'll come." I said, "Well, I'll go." Susan said, "That'll look gross, like I'm a whore or something. Just stay. It doesn't matter. I need to do this alone." Susan waited for me to move so she could climb from the car. I stepped outside. The parking lot was empty. There was a lamppost by the clinic and a sign hanging down that said government funded. That sounded bad. Not so much the funding, but the government. Susan climbed out, then reached back for her purse. She straightened her sweater and hugged me and whispered something I didn't hear. She kissed my ear. Matt was in the car down low. He couldn't see anything. My ear felt wet, tingly. She said, I don't even know which door I should use. We turned and looked at the building. There were lots of windows, but the only door, single glass, with a square handle, just like a Pizza Hut. Another car pulled into the lot. I heard the engine, but I didn't turn. Everything felt illegal, more illegal than smashing up a grocery store. Susan said, it's a fat old lady in a station wagon. I should go. She went. I watched. Her shoulders fell forward. Her hips barely moved. It was the same way my dad walked down the driveway on Saturdays when he had to be at work and he wanted to stay home. I climbed back into Nova. Matt said, tell me I was right, please. All she does is yell at me. You're right, I said. She's right, too. It's just a mess. After that, we listened to Motley Crue's first album. It was a great first album, the kind of record that made you want to smash people's mailboxes with a baseball bat. And we both loved it, but it was not the soundtrack we needed. We were not drinking beer or huffing glue or running back roads at reckless speeds. We were parked. We were scared. I thought that maybe Matt should marry Susan. I thought I should be the best man, or maybe I should marry Susan. I kicked around some cassettes on the passenger side floor until I found Cat Stevens' Greatest Hits. I popped it in with the volume turned down low. The acoustic guitars came on, slow strumming, and while Cat Stevens mostly sang about how awful the world was and how things never worked out between fathers and sons, he did it with bongos and lots of melody. Matt said, better, and closed his eyes. I said, much. I don't want to say we were happy, but for a few minutes, we forgot to complain.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Dave Newman. So, Dave, one of the things that I was really impressed by with the book, and it made me think back to when I was a teenager,
right,
is to be able to think about how I talked back then.
Yeah.
And in particular, you know, the book has a real authenticity to the language. There's a lot of declarative sentences, right, which I think is, it, to me, felt right. You're usually kind of narrating like, I did this and then right, I did that. In that scene where, you know, there's these very difficult situations that are going on, and then all of a sudden it's like, yeah, Motley Crue, I love that album, you know, that kind of stream of consciousness teenage thing going on. So I just wanted to ask you about, you know, the crafting of the language so that it felt real, how you went about that.
Well, I think, like, even though it's all teenagers, you know, it's told from 30 years ago, I wanted to have an adult narrator who could provide some sort of perspective. You know, I didn't want a first tense, you know, present tense,
sure,
book where people were in there, because it would just, it'd be relentless, it'd be obnoxious, it'd be American Pie, you know, it'd just be, it would be too much. So I wanted someone to be able to say, like, this is the way things were then, you know, and not apologize for it, but just say, like, you know, this is how teenagers act. And then there's also the scaling back. I think, like, there are moments my wife reads for me and she'd be like, I don't want to read about teenage boys doing this. And so you have that balance between, well, teenage boys do this, but maybe it doesn't need to go on for 15 pages to represent the reality of that, you know. So it's kind of always you're between the two.
Well, I was thinking about that with the book as well. It's a little over 200 pages,
right,
and you've got 52 chapters, so right, it goes at a clip.
Right, it does.
And even that, the, like, building the momentum of that, and, you know, there's the situation that you described, the one guy's girlfriend thinks she might be pregnant, right, and that's causing them to make some not very good choices,
right,
about what they're going to do about that, or think about making not so good choices as well. And so that's the main push of the book. And again, feeling very real to me, you know, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way about teenagers. Right. I love teenagers. I think they're awesome. I think they're fascinating.
Right. Right. As long as I'm not sitting next to them at Denny's at 2 a.m., they're great. You know?
But, you know, the problem that you have when you're that age, and I can remember that, is like the biggest problem in the world. And it's the only problem in the world. And you're just going to think it through and think it through and think it through.
Right.
And then to be able to turn that into narration and language and not have it just be like, I'm worried about my girlfriend if she's pregnant, or I'm not sure if I should do this thing that I'm thinking about doing or not.
Right.
So how did you keep the momentum going without it being awfully kind of self-involved, repetitive, as the character might want it to be?
Yeah. I think there's a thing like what the character wants versus what you want. and you kind of trust your characters. And I think, like, because it's first person, but the narrator is outside that, his best friend is the character who's gotten his girlfriend possibly pregnant. So he's kind of looking at their lives to give perspective. He's not involved in that. So you know, right. From the beginning of the book, he loves them and wants to save them, and they're the most important thing in his world. And by the end of the book, as teenagers do, he's just kind of caught up in it. But he's not even sure if he likes these people anymore, who were his best friends ever.
Right.
You know, he's just kind of floating away from them. And I think that's just kind of what happens with teenagers is this is relentless. I love this. I love you. We're going to save each other. Our parents are awful. And by the, you know, like 6 days later after some stuff happens, you're like, I'm kind of sick of it. You know, I'm sorry you might be pregnant. I'm sorry, you know, you're overdosing on drugs. But boy, you know, well, and Andy Griffith reruns are on too.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that in reading this in comparison to some other works is that you do start to realize how adult characters in books often are like thinking for 10 pages right. about this one particular thing. Right. And that wouldn't be right here because it's not going to happen.
Right. There aren't that many thoughts in a teenager's head. You know what I mean? Like, they're balancing up against they think the biggest crisis of their life up against we've got to get beer somehow. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like I'm not sure they know the difference.
Well, and there's something really kind of wonderfully naive about
yeah.
because that's the authentic, like those are their issues right then. And they're not worrying about how do I pay my mortgage
right.
or, you know, some of these other things that you get to think about for a lot of years afterwards.
I'm 40 and I still try to balance where do I get my beer and where do I pay my mortgage?
Good for you. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey and my guest tonight is the writer Dave Newman. Dave, how about you read some more for us?
Great. This is Danny, the main character, is waking up after a night where he and his best friend were out and they've were partying with women who are much older, meaning like 28 or so, which to them seems ancient. So he's trying to decide if he wants to go to school or not. The alarm clock sounded like a football coach blowing his whistle in my ear. I slapped at the snooze button. I stood up. I stretched. I'd meant to take off my shoes, but I'd passed out and now my feet ached. I undressed. I sat back down. My feet felt like balloons were being pricked but refused to pop. The prickling was worse when I stood. Behind the shade, the sun was out, but barely. It was 6:03. The bus came at 7. I'd fallen asleep at 2. I did the math. The math did not favor school. My mom was in the main bathroom. I could hear the water. The bathroom was bright pink with black and burgundy tile. Everything was old but well cared for. My mom wanted my dad to remodel, to update things. I stood outside the door. The door was open. My mom said, "I thought I heard your alarm." The curlers were out of her hair, but the curls were still loopy on her head. Her hair was dyed blonde, almost golden. She had a small towel tucked into her blouse so she wouldn't fleck her clothes with makeup. That was her word, fleck. She was pretty for her age. I could see that, but I didn't want to. She said, "Well, good morning." She went back to her makeup. I stood there in my white briefs. I knew I looked sick because I felt sick, even if that sick was just exhaustion and the desire to stay home. I waited to see if she thought I had the flu. She said, "I'll be out of here in 3 minutes." I said, "Take your time. I'll use Dad's shower." I didn't want to eat cereal, but eating cereal is what I did most mornings, so I found a box and a bowl and some milk. My mom had some sort of diet drink. She was always on a diet, even when she was eating whatever she wanted. She didn't look like she needed to lose weight, and she never lost any weight. I started eating my Honey Nut Cheerios. My mom said, "Well?" I said, "They're good." She said, "Not the Cheerios, the studying. How did it go?" "Okay," I said, and tried to remember my lies. She dumped her diet strawberry milk in the sink and said, "You lose weight because those things are undrinkable." She rinsed her glass and left it on the counter. She said, "Do you think you're ready?" She said, "What are the PSATs anyways? Your brother didn't have those, did he? Maybe he should have." I said, "The studying was fine. It was just some book." I took a mouthful of Cheerios and made loud crunching noises. I said, "I'm ready." She said, "Really?" I said, "Really." She said, "Your brother's not doing so good." I said, "I know." My brother was a freshman at Slippery Rock University. He'd bombed his first semester. Now he was on probation. My father was furious. He'd pinned my brother to a wall at Christmas break and said, "Look," then stopped himself before things escalated. My brother stayed on the wall. Then he locked himself in his bedroom. In the garage, my dad worked on the car, kicked tires, and tossed around tools. None of this was shocking. My brother had always been a terrible student. My dad had always been angry. But this was college, and everyone's failures had prices. Tuition, books, fees for student activities, and other things we didn't understand. My mom loved my brother. If he hadn't ever done well in school, she said, it was because he was bored. My mom had been bored. She had barely graduated from high school. Her parents hadn't graduated from high school. Church was important. Failing algebra was not. My mom believed her children to be geniuses. Geniuses in ways that schools couldn't or wouldn't grade. I was very polite. My brother had illustrated a poem for my great uncle's 60th birthday. My mom thought a C was a fine grade. It was important to memorize John 3:16 from the Bible. My dad did not think a C was a fine grade. He did not want to pay for C's or D's or F's, which were the three grades on my brother's first college report card. Going to church was not an excuse for doing terrible in school. My brother wanted to become an artist. He was artsy. He wanted to draw comic books for a living. He wanted someone else to write the words while he did the illustrations. He had a character he'd been working on, Track Failure, a former pole vaulter who quit the team to save the world. Track Failure wore a sweatsuit and carried a 12-foot fiberglass pole. Even my mom knew you couldn't draw that and survive. Suddenly people were talking about school in ways that were usually reserved for God, but it was late and almost none of it made sense. My mom said, it's important to do well on these tests. I said, I know. She said, are you in any clubs? College looked very highly on students who are involved in clubs and extracurricular activities. I said, extracurricular activities? What? She said, I've been reading. I said, I'm on student council. She said, what about football? I said, I quit. She said, I know you quit. I poured some more Cheerios into the remaining milk in my bowl. I thought I might puke. It was the way the Cheerios crumbled to wet dust in my mouth. She said, you might want to reconsider football. I said, I will, but I wasn't going to reconsider anything. She said, your brother quit playing track and now he's not doing so well. I said, he needs to go to class and quit drawing cartoons. She said, maybe. I said, definitely. She said, well, go to school and do good. If you have an art class, drop it and take something in science or math. She kissed me on the head and went to finish her makeup, even though her makeup looked perfect. I drank some juice. That was the most anyone had ever talked to me about school, about education and my future, and I didn't like it. I put the juice back. I brushed my teeth and put on my coat. I wasn't sure if I still smelled like booze, so I yelled goodbye to my mom and stumbled out the door.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Dave Newman. So one of the things I was thinking about with this book is that as someone who's not a teenager, hasn't been a teenager for a long time, I found the book very engaging and entertaining. But I could also see why it would also work for someone who is of that age. So when you were writing the book and thinking about like who this audience is that's going to read it, how are you negotiating that or trying to figure that out?
Yeah, I have little kids. I have my son's just turned 10 and my daughter's 6. I'm not sure I know what teenagers are interested in now. So I wouldn't know how – I mean, this might be like a teenager might really relate to this. Teenagers still might be teenagers. They might look at this and be like, this is stupid. Why aren't people choking each other more? So you're like, this isn't Chuck Palahniuk, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The Fight Club dude. Then you're like, why aren't they stabbing each other in the basement? So I'm not sure like what teenagers would think of it exactly.
Well, for me, it had to even in that selection that you were reading, there's something about that kind of and maybe it's because, you know, I teach as well, so I'm still right. Kind of engaged with teenagers right. On a regular basis. Kind of dry, sarcastic, kind of bored with the world, right. But I still want to come across as cool humor. And you got that
Thank you. Teenagers do seem more – the few I've had in my classes, more aggressive. Like I had a student, I handed back his poems, which are – really bad. Easy. I'm the easiest grader in the world. Like if you come to class and like smile, you get a B. And I gave him a C, which means like a normal person would give him an F. Handed him back to him right in front of me, coughed into his hand, said, "Bag," like straight to my face. It was just like, nice, you know.
Nice guy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like, we wouldn't, as bad as we were or as rough as the kids are in this book, you wouldn't have thought to do anything like that to an adult.
There was still
like this kids and adults, a separate world, and you respected even the worst adults.
Well, I definitely think there's a difference in the interaction.
Right.
That it is this kind of interactive world that if something happens, you're supposed to respond back. Right. And that's really different for me it in is. This last decade than what's happened before.
I think they spend so much time with their parents now that they almost think of adults as their peers. And so there's no like respect or anything like that. It's just, you know, well, I can say to you whatever I want to say to you, you know. And also, like, if you're teaching, it's like, I'm paying your salary, you know.
Yeah, I've had that comment made to me a couple times, and my response to that is always, no, you're paying to get my expertise for a limited time offer.
Absolutely.
How about you read a little bit more, Dave?
Great. Owl's Tavern opened at 7 in the morning, if necessary. That's what the sign said. 7 a.m., if necessary. The necessary done in block letters and magic marker. I'd been there before, usually for six-packs, sometimes for a drink at the bar. I didn't know if they would serve Matt, if his long hair added or subtracted years. One night, instead of buying the usual old Milwaukee tall boys to go, I ordered a beer and took a stroll. The only guy at the bar was a blind man, black-skinned with red freckles. His voice was a croak. He was at least 70. Huge wraparound sunglasses covered his eyes, and he hooked a walking cane around his wrists. He wore a handsome beige fedora and old denim overalls, and he kept insisting I looked exactly like his nephew, Jackson Winton III. He was missing teeth front and sides, but his smile worked. He said, "Jackson, you sound so white," and laughed and dropped his cane, and I picked it up and hooked it back over his wrists. I loved him. We bought each other beers until I thought I might throw up, then I went home. I came back two nights later. I ordered a six-pack and stayed for a beer. The same guy was there, but he didn't recognize me. He didn't hear my white voice and say, "You look exactly like my nephew, Jackson Winton III." The bartender that night was ancient. I could have stayed. The blind man might have found me. But two old guys came in, one in a wheelchair, and everyone moved to a table. So I finished my beer and left. Al's was a dump. I'd been in four other bars, and I knew. It smelled like urine and stale beer. The floor was dirty with pretzel pieces and peanut shells. There were vinyl booths, wobbly tables, and a wooden bar. Metal beer signs lined the walls. The walls were concrete and cinder block. The jukebox still spun 45s. The songs were sung by Hank Williams Sr., Hank Williams Jr., and AC/DC. 2 weeks later, I came back. I was drunk when I walked through the door. I went through the jukebox and played Highway to Hell 12 times, $3 worth. I drank a whiskey sour. I drank another. The music was loud. A guy wearing a shoe with a wooden heel walked over to the jukebox and unplugged the cord. He said, "Enough," but he said it like two words, E and enough. He was angry. I thought everyone was angry. I finished my drink and bought a bag of pretzels and left and didn't plan on coming back. Now it was 9:07 in the morning, and I knew I could get served, was sure I could get served, but maybe not. It wasn't uncommon for teenagers to drink in the dive bars of Western Pennsylvania back in the 80s, and I've been shaving since sixth grade, but every time I stepped into a bar, it felt like an audition. Maybe they remembered me at Owl's Tavern. Maybe I was a regular and expected, and someone would say, "Where you been?" and buy me a shot of bottom shelf liquor. But maybe I was a joke. Maybe I was worse than that. I'd been mocked. I'd been banned. Maybe I was the guy who played AC/DC until old men lost their hearing, or I was the guy who let a blind man buy him drinks. Matt said, "Let's make this day, seriously." I said, "Right. We're good at that." It was true. We had very few talents, but we were gold at spinning nothing into something with only time and a few beers. We looked at the sign. When, I thought, is it not necessary? We went back to Matt's car. If we wanted to succeed, we had to be perfect. There was my shirt and the fact that I'd shaved. I couldn't just grow hair on my chin, but I could change clothes. We swung back towards my house. I changed into cords and a plain Oxford shirt, for shoes, Docksiders. On my wrist, my dad's Timex, the fancy one he wore to church. Our plan was this. I would stumble into the bar looking more or less like I didn't swing a pickaxe for a living or drive a dump truck into giant ditches for union wages. I'd ask the barkeeper, the old Alkies, if any were at the bar, if they'd seen Matt. Then I'd describe Matt like I knew him, but not really. Liked him, but not really. Never, of course, mentioning his age. Matt said, "The worst thing they can do is kick us out." I said, "The worst thing they can do is arrest us." We were driving the speed limit back into Harmony. My dad's watch was killing me. The metal band pulled at my arm hairs. Matt said, "How'd you find this place?" I said, "I went looking."
So, Dave, you're known as a poet, for sure, okay. around town.
I'll take that.
That's a good thing. And now you've ventured into the world of fiction. And so there's a couple things I'm wondering about that. One is kind of what was the impulse, you know, why you decided to do that. And then if the writing, you know, if or how the writing felt different.
I always kind of wrote poetry and fiction together. I published more poetry. Mm-hmm. And when I first started writing, there was no internet or anything. I wouldn't have had any idea how to publish a novel. So I'd written novels. I just chucked on the shelf and just thought, well, someday these might be useful or something like that. And then
some people golf, you write novels.
It wasn't quite like that. But I mean, I also thought I was kind of the school that, like, if you want to write, you have to write. And like, I grew up with working class people and I didn't do very like good in grad school and in that environment. So I thought I have to write more and better than these people. You know, I have to do more. So I always had like a good work ethic towards that stuff. But I really just wasn't like very astute at publishing early on. So I would just like – I would write things and like I said just set them aside and then I would rewrite them. And then I had a kid. I didn't have any time anymore, like a job and a wife and a kid. And I thought like, well, now would be the time to maybe start like looking into publishing and things like that. And it became with the internet. You could look up things that like – I mean, we used to have – do you remember the International Directory of Small Presses?
Yeah.
It was like a giant encyclopedia.
Yeah.
You'd have to go through and read 1,000 pages to find a magazine you wanted to publish in. And suddenly you had the internet and you could figure out where to do these things. And your poems got around and it was just a totally different experience. I mean, this came about an editor saw my poems in a magazine and said, do you have a novel? Because a publisher would like a novel. Someone might buy that, I think, more than a book of poems. And I was like, yeah, I do. And
so excellent.
It just kind of happened like that.
Is there a different way that you approach the writing or is it still kind of coming from the same place?
Even if they're the same, even if I write a really narrative poem, they come from completely different sides of my brain. I have no idea why. Like, I think someone who doesn't like narrative poetry would look at my poems and be like, oh, this is a story. And I couldn't turn it into a story. Even if there's a story in the narrative, I couldn't turn it into prose. It just wouldn't work for me. And so they come from totally different places. They form differently. And my wife writes prose and poetry. She pilfers her own stuff constantly. Like if a magazine contacts her and they're like, we need an essay, she'll take a poem she's been working on, just chuck it into essay form and work with it. I wouldn't even know how to do that. So they come from different headspaces.
Great. Well, thanks for coming to Prosody, Dave.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner. Please tune in every Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.